Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'll be moderating today's webinar on HHS's new call to action, a prescription for updating healthcare and cybersecurity practices. I'll admit from the outset that I didn't think of this webinar topic. I've learned that when smart people like Leslie Bender tell you that a topic might make for a good webinar, she's really usually right, and it makes sense to listen to her and hold the webinar. So I want to thank Leslie for coming to me with this idea today on a very important topic that does not get enough attention in the credit and collection industry, that being cybersecurity. I'm thrilled to have Leslie and Mike right here today to share their insights on this topic. I want to take a quick minute before I get too far into my introduction and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Leslie Bender has spent more than 30 years handling compliance, regulatory, transactional, and legal matters for hospitals and financial services companies. Recognized as a national expert on HIPAA and other information privacy and security laws, she was one of the first privacy officers internationally accredited as a certified information privacy professional. Currently, Leslie is the Chief Strategy Officer and General Counsel for BCA Financial Services, a Miami, Florida headquartered financial services company. Bender is a past president of the ACA International, serving as ACA's president in 2013-2014, and as an officer of its board of directors from 2011 to 2015. She earned her undergraduate degree from Northwestern University and her law degree from the University of Notre Dame. Go Irish. With over 15 years of IT and cybersecurity experience focused on the ARM space, Michael Wright is one of the industry's leading cybersecurity experts. Most recently, Wright served as the chief security officer for TechLock, a firm specializing in financial services and healthcare cybersecurity consulting. He has spent the past decade assisting many of the industry's leading agencies reduce their cybersecurity risks, improve their security posture, and ensure compliance with a myriad of applicable laws and regulations. Today, he is a cybersecurity evangelist at large and is uniquely qualified to help organizations address the cybersecurity threat of tomorrow. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please type it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. And finally, today's event is an audio only event. So if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. With that, let me ask Mike Wright the first question. Are the cyber risks or threats different that you see coming in 2019?
Thanks, Mike. Not particularly. Ransomware came on the scene in the popular news around 2016 or so, but between 2016 and 2018 and now going to 2019, what we're really seeing is cyber threats becoming more complex, more sophisticated, more difficult to detect, but there hasn't really been a sea change or a paradigm shift in the types of attack vectors that hackers and other malicious bad guys are using. On the cybersecurity tools front, we're seeing more and more AI-based solutions out there to help sort of detect these more complex, more sophisticated attacks. But there really isn't anything critical between 2017 and 2019 from a cybersecurity standpoint that has changed. We did see some new popular attack vectors from the hardware space come through last year, things like Spectre and Meltdown, which affected Intel processors. We may see some more of that coming down the pipe in 2019, but it's really difficult to tell.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for setting the table for us. Let's start talking about this document in particular from the Department of Health and Human Services that we're referring to. What is it? What's in it? What's in its goal? What's its goal? Sorry.
I can feel that one too. So this document was released by a task group that's working with the Department of Health and Human Services. It's actually a public-private partnership called the Healthcare and Public Health Sector Coordinating Council. And this publication is actually four separate documents. The main document, which most people are probably aware of, is sort of an overview document that covers what the five threats are, what the 10 practices are, which are supposed to meet those five threats. It also includes two technical volumes, one intended specifically for small businesses and one intended specifically for medium and large businesses, and a resources and templates document, which is super useful. It has a lot of templates and links to different things that could be useful for any size organization, like a HIPAA security rule guidance document, incident report templates, policy templates, a security risk assessment tool, lots of really cool information in there. But what it's intended for is it's tailored to the healthcare industry, I guess, first and foremost. It's and when I say tailored, it does include the vendor and supplier ecosystem, like billing partners, collection agencies, that sort of thing. But as with most publications that come out of the Department of Health and Human Services, the primary audience seems to be healthcare providers themselves. That being said, it is a good exercise for any organization that deals with protected health information to use this as an opportunity to review our own cybersecurity preparedness in the context of the guidelines that are in here.
Yeah, I would completely agree with Mike. And I think one of the quotes that really jumps out at you from the document is, you know, their claim that a cybersecurity prevention and cybersecurity controls and strategies are really meant to be sized to fit your organization, like all things HIPAA. And the quote that really catches your attention is that HHS feels that healthcare organizations must practice good cyber hygiene in today's digital world by including cybersecurity as an everyday universal precaution. HHS goes on to say, like hand washing, cyber awareness does not have to be complicated or expensive. In fact, simple cybersecurity practices, such as always logging off of a computer when finished working, are very effective at protecting information that is sensitive and private. And I think that, as Mike inferred, that is the message of this call to action. It is all premised on a law that was passed in 2015, but the idea here is, you know, when we harness the convenience of different technological solutions, are we really sure we have a pretty decent understanding of how they work, where data is stored on them, you know, how to make sure that the mindset of our workforce is consistent with some of the threats and concerns. And although the documents are considerable, they are truly meant to be accessible.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, especially one of the things that I kind of appreciated about this publication is in the Technical Volume 1, which is meant for small businesses, that includes different practices that small businesses could implement to reduce their cybersecurity risk, it really did concentrate on solutions that cost little to no money to implement. It's really all about having the right practices and day-to-day activities and security awareness and that sort of thing in your organization without having to go buy the most expensive intrusion prevention system or centralized audit logging platform or that sort of thing.
The traditional framework in the cybersecurity lifecycle tends to task focus on activities like identify, protect, detect, respond, recover. Is that the case in this situation as well?
I'll jump in and grab that first, and Mike, chime in anytime. I definitely think that is what this document focuses on. As Mike mentioned earlier, a lot of the information that comes out really just continues to repurpose and reapply some of the basic principles. It is critical for us to be able to identify what things can source danger or risk for us. It is critical for us to identify what our budgets are and our means are and our business priorities when we figure out how much we truly can invest dollars and cents wise, as well as people wise and resource wise, to protect ourselves. And if we don't have a lot of resources currently available to us to identify and or protect things, then the hope would be that we have a series of controls that allow us to detect things pretty quickly. which is why we always hearken back to what is the mindset of your workforce. And once you detect stuff, what are the means by which you're going to respond to it? I know Mike Wright and I have had the chance over the past few years to talk to organizations about how important tabletop exercises are, namely when you take a fact pattern, you take your incident response team, you tell them we just detected this, now what do? And you put people in a room for half an hour or longer and you say, tell us what our organization's compliance program tells us we should do or what good common sense. Because a lot of times when you run these tabletop exercises, first of all, people learn from each other in other departments and perhaps don't see the compliance and the IT people like peculiar people on the management team. Mm-hmm. But also tabletop exercises give people a chance to flex their wings and put to use some of the compliance tools that you have. And then finally, recovery. And hopefully your recovery won't be very serious because hopefully you have the means to detect stuff quickly. I don't know, Mike, if you want to comment or add to that.
Yeah, sure. So most people listening to this this webinar are probably familiar with management methods like the plan, do, check, act cycle or plan, do, check, adjust cycle. This is sort of something similar. It's meant to be a continuous cycle of risk management. The five steps that Leslie mentioned, for example, that you identify, protect, detect, respond, recover, and then you start the whole cycle over again. I totally agree, Leslie. When it comes to identifying risks, whether it's the specific threats or vulnerabilities that are discussed in this publication, or it's just a general part of an organization risk management practice, actually going through and checking these, whether it's with tabletop exercises, real-world scenarios, penetration testing, outside risk assessments, that sort of thing, it's very useful in helping make sure that you can actually address threats that are relevant to your organization. It's one thing just to get one of these documents or something like the SANS Top 20, or if you look at any of the other regulations or standards out there, like PCI DSS, the HIPAA security rule, et cetera. Looking at those sorts of standards, those sorts of control sets, in many cases are a one-size-fits-all type of deal. Where the difficult part comes in is actually tailoring those. How do these risks or how do these control sets apply to my organization? And what can we actually do to protect our organization, to detect these risks or these threats, respond to them when they actually do happen, and then recover from them after they happen?
Yeah, and Mike, that reminds me of conversations that we've had over time about what risks are truly foreseeable. This document sort of zeroes in on different types of threats and proposes some strategies or activities for getting to things. I mean, I think that, we have been to enough airports that see something, say something is not unusual to us, but when we consider the equation for how do we really know that our technology and our tactics are appropriately addressing what are reasonably foreseeable risks, I guess we have to laugh a little bit that, if risks were truly foreseeable, then wouldn't we have done something about them? And so the variables we would find in this calculation would be, how vulnerable are we to something? What is the real threat? How likely is it to happen in our organization? And if it did happen, what is the impact? And where those intersect is sort of where I think, at least from a sort of legal or compliance perspective, we would expect to find the types of risks, and we could risk rate them to decide what we want to do something about in the near future versus the not so near future. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And if you look at the actual five threats that this document discusses, email phishing, ransomware, loss or theft of equipment or data, insider, accidental or intentional data loss, and then attacks against connected medical devices. So if we take the top two, for example, email phishing and ransomware, these are threats that affect every or that may impact any organization of any size, of any type. But these two types of attacks specifically have also been in the news, you know, regarding some recent breaches, not just in the healthcare industry, but they do tend to impact the healthcare industry pretty severely. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And the important part here is the tailoring, right? So a ransomware attack may impact a collection agency different from a hospital network, but the threat is still there. It's all going to depend on the specifics of the organization. What is your data flow? Where is all your information stored? How have you applied your access control? That sort of thing.
So I guess then the question is, Mike, if we're, you know, if we think, oh, geez, we're a relatively small company with a pretty small target on our back, all things considered, why would anybody go after us? You know, wouldn't they find a large health system more attractive than us? And I guess then you have to start looking at those vendor relationships you were talking about and see if someone could get into your sort of IT perimeter and could begin to make use of some of the connections you have to, for example, payment portals or, you know, credit reporting information or people's credit files and things like that. Somehow people could burrow in. You know, that potentially could pose some risks, even for little guys, that are pretty formidable. Would you agree with that?
I do. It also, there's a bit of psychology involved as well when it, you know, to address the first part of your comment, you know, I'm just a small company. No one's going to target me. That's usually not the way it works when it comes to these types of threats. There are two reasons why even a smaller organization may be impacted by these types of threats. One is the low-hanging fruit, right? Many malicious actors out there will basically, in the most simplified sense, they'll scan the internet looking for open doors, looking for weaknesses, looking for exploitable vulnerabilities. And it's pretty indiscriminate. If you're connected to the internet as an organization, you're being scanned all of the time. So just by virtue of the fact that you're a small organization and that you may not be specifically targeted really doesn't mean you're safe from these types of threats. And secondly, smaller organizations, you know, it's fairly obvious that they probably don't have the budget for dedicated cybersecurity staff for the most expensive intrusion prevention systems, et cetera, et cetera. That in itself sometimes provides a tempting target for smaller businesses. In fact, there are a couple of interesting statistics inside this document. I think one of those is that 58% of malware attack victims, so these are things like ransomware, for example, are small businesses. So if you think about that, I mean, you can definitely tell just by virtue of the fact that you're a small business doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to be targeted.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Because, of course, you know, we sort of watch the statistics of that great privacy research group, the Poneman Institute, and, of course, data breach cost per record in healthcare is almost double what it would be in other industries. You know, like, is it important for small organizations to be mindful of social media connections that people have or phishing attacks, or, you know, should there be some sort of social engineering testing even for little companies, or can we kind of rely on the mindset because the employees are close to the owners? What do you think about all that?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the things that this document actually does fairly well is it really concentrates, especially for smaller businesses, on the fact that you don't necessarily need all of this monitoring and data loss prevention technology. If you really just concentrate on security awareness, making sure employees understand, you know, how to recognize potential phishing emails, potential social engineering attempts, et cetera, and then applying some pretty basic technical measures, which are pretty commonly available among different email systems, for example, of you know, maybe appending something to an email to say, hey, this is an external email. Think before you click on any links or that sort of thing. You can really get rid of or mitigate a lot of the risk regarding these types of threats. Sure, there are technologies that you can implement that can that can monitor, you know, the internet, the so-called dark web, social media, email, et cetera. But those sorts of tools are expensive and are typically only going to be available for medium and larger size businesses who have the budget to deal with those. So really, if you just concentrate on some of the most basic, right? The old saying is that humans can be the weakest link in the chain of cybersecurity, but they can also be the strongest link. So really concentrating on the right sort of training, I think, can mitigate a lot of that risk.
Yeah, I think you're right, Mike. This document really does make the point that nobody is too small to fail here, and that so much money is lost in breaches or security incidents, whether they are large or small, each year. And it's pretty difficult to replicate your own personal health record if it's been hacked or compromised. And it can lead to some pretty dire, life-threatening consequences. So one of the things that also caught my attention about this document was the flu analogy. What do you think about the flu analogy that HHS uses? They use the hand-washing analogy and the flu analogy. How do you think they provide guidance to us when we consider, wow, we're a multiple hospital health system, or geez, we're just a billing or collections business associate for larger organizations? How does the flu fit here?
Yeah, I sort of like how they did that analogy. So in the document, they talk about how the flu virus itself could be considered a threat. And if you think about how the flu virus might impact different people differently, or, you know, to follow through with the analogy, different organizations differently, the flu virus, for example, might be able to impact an elderly person more so because they have different vulnerabilities. They may have a compromised immune system or maybe, you know, less physical strength. So the flu virus might be able to exploit those vulnerabilities and impacts the elderly person more than maybe a younger or healthier person. So it's very similar with these types of threats, the ransomware, the email phishing, loss of data, et cetera. It's all really just depends on this, on the type of your organization, what sort of business model you have, what your data flows are. You're going to have different vulnerabilities of companies that either provide different types of services or are larger and smaller or smaller than you. So it's a matter of identifying those vulnerabilities and coming up with the right countermeasures that might mitigate the threat. So, you know, countermeasures for the flu might be things like getting a flu shot, making sure you wash your hands and sanitize correctly, that sort of thing.
So, you know, with my compliance officer's hat on, it seems to me that a great place for people to start would be to say, look at some of your most important clients, however it is you define most important. Is it based on revenue or about, you know, your relationship in the community in which you do business or whatever? Would it make sense to make some inquiries about what type of privacy and data security training, you know, is ongoing, or protocols might be being implemented or initiatives for the coming year to make sure that you sync up to them? Would that be, I mean, from a compliance perspective, that seems like what would be a good idea, but what about from a cyber risk perspective?
Yeah, that is a great idea. In fact, in the healthcare industry, information sharing in the cybersecurity space has actually been ongoing through some pioneering organizations like the HITRUST Alliance, for example, hold regular meetings on the latest threats in cybersecurity in the healthcare space. The sharing of information, the sharing of new issues that you've been seeing, what may be coming down the pipe, what your own company's initiatives are, and sharing that not just with your clients but with your vendors and service providers, that's got to only serve to further the conversation, right? To keep cybersecurity in front, in center of people's minds. But you know, one thing that we've been kind of talking about throughout this webinar so far is we've talked about threats, we've talked about vulnerabilities, we talked about risks, there's likelihood, there's impact. So keeping your compliance officer's hat on, can you kind of explain, just so we can get a level playing field when it comes to, like, you know, what do you see, what's a threat, what's a vulnerability, what's a risk, and why do we have specific definitions for these?
That's a great question. And I think that, you know, as a compliance officer, you always wish you had a crystal ball, because, you know, something that may seem innocent that you sort of kept sight of on the periphery may ultimately blossom into something more serious. And you wish with some regret that you would have dealt with it. And I think that all of the variables in the foreseeable risk calculation merit some consideration from a compliance perspective. So let's start with impact. You know, one of the most challenging things when you are functioning from the sort of non-revenue generating component of an organization is that you really have to be able to demonstrate what the impact would be to the organization if something came to pass. Now, of course, we never know exactly what's going to come to pass, right? But it would be very important to sort of have an understanding of what the impact would be. So if, for example, it would be embarrassing, or if, for example, we'd be able to reset all of our computers if, you know, threat X came to pass, and we could self-remedy with reasonable certainty, we might not want to invest in a full FTE to keep an eye on that all day. So the impact, you know, would we be out of business for a day? Would we be out of business for a year? Would we be out of business for a month? You know, if we're trying to decide if we should upgrade our telephony or invest in more IT or legal or compliance resources, the impact might be something that we would really pay a lot of attention to, right? So likelihood, you know, if the impact on our organization would be huge, but the likelihood it would really occur in our space is nil or near nil, then obviously, you know, we wouldn't want to spend a lot of time concerning ourselves with it, other than to make sure over time that the likelihood doesn't change. Threat, there's lots of threats out there all day long. One could argue that every time someone pings maliciously against our firewall, there's a threat. But so long as our firewall keeps the bad guys out, I guess, you know, we aren't worried about the impact of those. Vulnerability kind of reflects a more ethereal thing. You know, do we really think that the way that we are organized today leaves us vulnerable for certain things? So back to your comment, oh geez, you know, many organizations really can't afford, nor does it make good business sense for them to have their own cyber risk full-time employee. They feel safer utilizing somebody who, you know, perhaps has many different relationships with different industries and has a broader scope of experience that stays current. But that, of course, leaves you vulnerable, because then when you need help for something, you have to go outside. You might have to wait in line with other organizations to wait for your cyber risk resource to become available to you in order to jump on something. So I think that each of these things from a compliance perspective has to be weighed and reweighed on a fairly regular basis. We can't say, okay, we did it 3 years ago, we don't have to worry about it again, because for heaven's sake, every time you buy a new piece of technology or you download a new enhancement, it behooves you from a compliance perspective to know how it works. You know, I think a lot of us have experienced a lot of learning curves on understanding how different types of telephony platforms work, how these application programming interfaces or APIs work. You know, how is something going to connect and what information is being exchanged back and forth? And when we agree to connect our collection platform to something else, does it leave us vulnerable in some way if some of the great tools that we add or we connect to aren't as secure as our mothership or our home base? I think that's kind of from a compliance perspective how I would see some of those things. How would you see some of these things as a cyber risk person?
Sure. So actually, before I answer that, I just really liked your alluding to sort of the black box of technology, right? It's not enough anymore just to have that system in your environment. You really need to know how it works, how it interfaces with other systems, other applications, so that you can actually measure the risk. But yes, from a cybersecurity perspective, you sort of alluded to this as well, but if you think about these as variables, there's, you know, you have risk as maybe your end result, but you have your threat, your likelihood, your impact, et cetera. It's almost like a mathematical equation. Whether or not you want to quantitatively measure risk or qualitatively measure your risk, if anybody remembers their high school algebra out there, it's really just a matter of assigning values to these variables and then plugging them into an equation. So from a cybersecurity perspective, it's definitely, you know, if you're expecting to actually affect change as a result of identifying risks and whether you're mitigating it by eliminating it, insuring against it, et cetera, then you really need to concentrate on ensuring that you assign appropriate values to these variables. You plug it into the equation to determine the actual risk imposed on your organization. So for example, you know, there are these meltdown inspector viruses, or not viruses, vulnerabilities that were in the news throughout the middle of last year. For many organizations, although, you know, these were deemed to be some pretty high priority or critical vulnerabilities, due to other sorts of compensating controls that companies have within their computer networks, it really wasn't all that big of a deal for many organizations to just wait for a patch to come out and then make sure the patch gets installed. So it's, like I said, it's really just a matter of tailoring the risk to your organization, which I guess tying it back to this document, one of the other things that I liked about it was that it actually did include, for each of the five major threats that the document identifies, it included a list of particular potential vulnerabilities that your organization may have that you may not be aware of, and actually what the impact of a threat exploiting those vulnerabilities may come out to. So for example, the email phishing attack, which was the first threat that the document mentions, say that a lack of security awareness may actually be a vulnerability within your organization. If your employees don't really know how to identify a potential phishing email, then a phishing email may exploit that vulnerability. And then what's the impact of that? Maybe their credentials, their password is stolen. Maybe they bring, you know, as part of that phishing attack, they now have a gateway into your network and can bring your network down. Now you have an inability to conduct business. So the second one, ransomware attack, potential vulnerability there that the ransomware may exploit is maybe you don't have appropriate system backups. So when all of your data is now encrypted by this ransomware attack, you don't have any way to restore it on your own. You're going to have to try to decide, can you live without that data? Do you want to pay the ransom and potentially get a copy of the data back, et cetera? So, you know, the impact there is a partial or complete disruption of your business. But the vulnerabilities may be different for different organizations. So it's really just a matter of determining, you know, what your security posture is and how you can address these specific threats.
Yeah, and I think that some of these seem like that could never happen to me. But then when you flip over and you look at sort of the enforcement history of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the top two concerns that seem to recur in the pattern of enforcement actions are, you know, improper or impermissible uses and disclosures of, you know, protected health information, which could be as simple as I'm on the telephone and I feel this compulsion to be helpful and I start talking about, you know, all sorts of things about people's information that go well beyond the true role that I play in that call as a collection agent or as a customer service rep or something of that nature, to the more criminal or, you know, there have been a lot of enforcement actions where actually, you know, physicians employed in a health system cannot help themselves but stroll through medical records, taking some interest in reviewing details on people that aren't even their patients. The second issue that I think is seem so innocent on its face, but really applies to all of us, is a lack of sufficient safeguards to protect information. And the safeguards that you are expected to have in healthcare reflect a balancing. Those safeguards have to be safeguards of integrity, confidentiality, and availability. And so if, you know, we hire Mike to come on site and Mike locks down all of our resources that have sensitive information, yay, we will have met our cybersecurity challenges, but sadly, we really won't be able to meet our duty to safeguard the availability of the information when it's truly needed. And I think that when we look at the list that you've gone through, the email phishing, the ransomware, the loss or theft, insider accidental or intentional data loss, maybe we want to drill into that insider accidental or intentional data loss a little bit more, Mike, because it seems to me that the most popular enforcement actions, impermissible uses and disclosures and lack of safeguards, tend to roll up to that threat. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's simultaneously one of the easiest and most difficult threats to mitigate against, depending on how an organization may have set up their data flow, set up their applications. So, for example, let's take a typical collection agency, for example, or debt collector. There's a centralized system that, you know, most of these sorts of companies have that does a really good job at protecting the information within that system of record with access controls, with audit logging, et cetera, with role-based access control. However, what many organizations of that type neglect once they've locked down sort of their keys to the kingdom in that system of record is all of the files that get imported into that system that are kept as a safeguard somewhere on the network, all of the reports and other files that get exported out of that system, whether it's to go to their own vendors or service providers, to go back to their clients, et cetera. Those are all typically sitting on a file share somewhere, maybe even on a file share on that collection server itself, with limited to no access control. Because many different roles within that organization may need access to one or two types of reports or one or two files. I see these file shares as wide open. So from a threat perspective, sure, the centralized system of record is going to be a pretty tough nut to crack. But the malicious insider or the malicious hacker doesn't really need to get access to that if they can just access the call recordings that are sitting on the QA file share or the recall files that are sitting on an FTP folder somewhere within the network that haven't been locked down.
So should we be more worried, Mike, about bad stuff coming in or good stuff getting out?
I don't know if there's like a, if I can give you like a 70-30 type percentage, but I think it is, we do need to worry about both directions. Data loss prevention, preventing the good stuff from getting out is notoriously such a difficult thing to implement because, you know, most organizations look at data loss prevention and think you need some sort of expensive tool that you need to install on all of your computers, all of your servers, et cetera. But, in line with the guidance from this document that we're discussing today, you really don't necessarily need to go in and buy that sort of software. As long as you have the appropriate access control in all of the storage locations of the important data within your organization, if you have some pretty basic firewall rules blocking all outbound traffic that's not necessary, and as long as you're logging when people are accessing files, not just in your centralized system of record, but in all the other locations on the network where they're being backed up to, they're being exported out to, you can put the kibosh on a lot of that sort of the good stuff getting out. And when it comes to the bad stuff getting in, that's traditionally been the focus of a lot of cybersecurity practices in the past, making sure that the hackers can't get in. But within the past, 5 to 7 years or so, with the prevalence of so-called client-side attacks, where you can go to a legitimate website, and maybe there's an ad on the website that's a malicious ad, and it installs some malware on your computer, the most sophisticated attacks can completely bypass your firewall and affect your system directly. So keeping the bad stuff getting out is almost the same at this point, the good stuff getting out is almost the same as stopping the bad stuff from getting in, because you have to have a lot of the same controls in place on the local systems and local networks.
So let's take a look at some of these threats in the report, and let's kind of talk through, you know, one thing that is a question I get a lot after a workshop or a teleseminar is, wow, that was a lot of information. As soon as I hung up, I was so energized to act and I didn't know what my next step should be. So, Mike, would you consider indulging me in going through these five categories and maybe share from an IT perspective? You told us at the beginning, hey, you know, there are solutions that all of us can implement in regard to these five categories of threats. Would you indulge me in maybe walking through these and saying, okay, when you hang up the phone, what would be some strategies that we should consider?
Sure. Actually, but before we get into that, I just wanted to address one of the questions that was submitted by one of the attendees. So the question is, do the panelists agree that while HHS claims this is voluntary and that ultimately compliance is to be expected, and that enforcement, either as part of a separate action or in and of itself as a failure to comply with these voluntary items, enforcement will occur based on these items. So as our legal expert, Leslie, how'd you like to address that one?
Well, and I know Mr. Brownlee well, who has submitted this. Actually, he and I had the opportunity to work on a data security compliance program a year or two ago. Welcome, Scott. One of the things that I think is very interesting to think about there is that, you know, things have a funny way of becoming a standard because a regulator put them out there. And whenever I hear the phrase best practices or, you know, this is the result of some interdisciplinary consensus, they seem to have the potential to set a standard by which we could be found to be negligent if we fail to abide. So while these might not have force of law, I think we certainly can see that these do set a standard or a set of expectations. And I think that from a compliance or a legal perspective, and of course this is not legal advice, we should see if we can hold ourselves to those standards. You know, in Scott's own organization versus my own organization, how we would size to fit some of the things that Mike Wright has talked to us about today would probably be very different. Because even if we're the same type organization, we might have slightly different client bases. We might be vendors to different type of organizations. We might use vendors that differ from the vendors of each other. Maybe we have some geographic differences to worry about. You know, I'm pretty sure that Scott's company was not down for 10 days during Irma, which a lot of the Southern Florida-based companies were, because there simply was no electricity. So I think that we should assume that these are a guideline or a set of expectations. And while they may not be absolute legal mandates, we can assume that they will establish some indication of a standard of care to which we should live. And that's kind of a lawyer's look at that, I think.
So when you say standard of care, would you say, or at least would you agree that at a minimum, you know, if there's some record that as part of a formal risk assessment, an organization has looked at these guidelines in this document and determines the applicability for their organization, that can that itself be enough of a standard of care, even if they have decided as an organization that, you know, we don't necessarily need to implement this or follow that guideline?
Well, it certainly is a good start. And one of the things that I think is really cool about data security is this idea that different things you do have different levels of maturity. So I think that would be a great start, Mike. But I don't think if you identified you had a risk and you knew about it and you didn't put it into your to-do list with some, you know, either because as something important but not urgent, or you know, you didn't stage it somewhere, but you knew you had a risk the whole time. I think that that could come back to bite you. If you identify a risk and you have absolutely no sense of needing to put it into your to-do list ever, I think that that could get you into some mischief.
Gotcha. That makes sense. All right. So with that aside, to jump into these five threats and these 10 practices, one of the things I wanted to mention is that if you look at all of the different laws, all the different regulations, all the different standards, all the different client requirements out there, it's easy to become a deer in the headlights with, you know, if you look at all the hundreds and hundreds of different nuances and different controls that you have to apply to be compliant with all this stuff. In this document, they only list five of the most critical threats that they see for the healthcare industry, and list only 10 practices, overall practices, you know, with some more specifics inside that are meant to address these five threats. So keeping that in mind, taking a look at these five threats and these 10 practices and see how they may apply to your organization could be really useful in knocking out maybe some additional risk assessment activities or cybersecurity or compliance activities that you may already have to do for other reasons. So the first,
go ahead.
I was going to jump into the threats. So if you had something to add to that, go ahead.
No, please jump away.
All right. So the first one, email phishing attack. Nowadays, almost nobody is unaware of the phishing threat out there. And again, you're talking about email phishing, phishing. Most people know what a phishing attack is, right? It's an email that appears to come from a legitimate source. And then by virtue of performing an action based on that email, whether it's opening a file, clicking a link, or maybe even doing a wire transfer from one bank account to another because you think it's from your CEO or from your chief financial officer, et cetera. It's going to provide some sort of harm or loss to your organization. The phishing attack threat definitely impacts organizations of all sizes, small, medium, and large. And we've already discussed some of the vulnerabilities that may be exploited by these phishing attacks, like lack of security awareness, or maybe an email system that can't detect malicious links or that sort of thing. When it comes to...
Yeah, and I...
Go ahead.
I think that if for folks that are following along at your office, there are, you know, there in the executive summary document that Mike referenced at the beginning, if you flip to page 16 and 17, you can follow along with us. Go ahead, Mike. Keep going.
Yeah, oh, no problem. I'm not sure if all the attendees can see the answered questions or not, but we did post a link to where those documents are available from in the answered questions tab. The second threat, a ransomware attack. Again, you know, this is something that's been in the news quite a bit since 2016 or so. Virtually everybody knows what a ransomware attack is, but what many organizations still fail to do is really implement some of the most basic practices that could limit the exploitation of this type of vulnerability. I talked about things like lack of an appropriate system backup and restore capability. The easiest and most, and typically the recommended thing to do when you're hit by a ransomware attack is once you've eradicated the infection, just restore from your last known backup if you can. If you have, you know, the most common attack vector by these types of threats are unpatched software. If you think about like your Adobe Acrobat Reader, your Java, et cetera, you don't necessarily need an IT guru to make sure that these things stay up to date. And just by virtue of doing that, you can prevent a lot of these types of attacks. And then lastly, I talked about access control on things like file shares, where you may have a lot of corporate company confidential information, a lot of PII or PHI in these file shares, just making sure that access controls are truly locked down so that only people who need access to this type of data can actually get access to it can help prevent ransomware from really spreading across the network. The third threat, loss or theft of equipment or data. So this could be If we're talking about equipment, it could be a laptop or a tablet. It could be a USB or a thumb drive. It could be a mobile phone, since many of those have access to email, which may have, you know, this sort of confidential information in it. And, you know, Leslie and I were talking the other day, we were talking about encryption on laptops, for example. You know, back in the day, you'd have to go and buy a package for this. Nowadays, there are free or very inexpensive methods of doing things like full disk encryption on laptops or on mobile phones, or even on USB drives that a lot of organizations, just for some reason or another, don't appear to be taking advantage of. Leslie, one question I had for you when it comes to encryption is, if an encrypted laptop or a mobile phone or similar device is stolen, does that change like the notification requirements that you've had a breach or notification to consumers?
Well, it could, but of course we would have to look at what data is actually potentially on that piece of equipment. Many of the laws have a no harm, no foul standard, but you have to be able to document how you came to the conclusion that the loss or theft of a device, even if encrypted, still couldn't be put at risk information somehow in an unencrypted way. For example, for mobile professionals, sometimes organizations have a way that you can log into the device through the encryption tool. But also, if you just wanted to check your email, you could get to Outlook or a 365 or some other cloud-based tool without having to go tunnel through any sort of encryption. And I think that it would be important to know that there is no way to get in other than through the encryption, and that maybe after you get through the encryption of the tool itself, then you have to follow through a VPN tunnel or some other place to get to real information. But many laws do have a fail-safe that if you have taken advantage of encryption and the device is stolen or lost, that you would not have to consider it to be a breach, although it most assuredly would be a security incident. In any event, having some sort of training for your workforce to make sure they know to report stuff, even if it was encrypted, if it was misplaced, would be a good idea.
Gotcha. Yep, that makes sense. So moving on to the fourth threat, this one we've already discussed a little bit regarding the accidental or intentional data loss, potentially from an insider. We talked about access controls, et cetera. The last one may not really impact a ton of the attendees of this webinar. So attacks against connected medical devices that may affect patient safety. So one of the anecdotes that I have for this one is, some of you may remember in the news that I think it was 2007, Vice President Dick Cheney had gotten a new pacemaker, and he actually had the wireless capability in his pacemaker disabled because of a potential threat against the pacemaker, maybe assassination threat or that sort of thing. But when it comes to connected devices in general, the Internet of Things, IoT, is something that's at the forefront of a lot of people's minds these days, we're talking about like bring your own device type things for the office or even at home. You're talking about your washer, your dryer, your refrigerator, et cetera. Connected devices that are not necessarily like laptops or servers do constitute a legitimate threat, to networks, again, whether it's personal or business. Did you have something to add to that, Leslie?
No, I just think that it's important. You know, there was an interesting series of stories last week about how people could get into computing resources because now they're, we do so many more video conferences and, pretty inexpensively, you can buy little computer video cameras and stuff. And none of us really know for sure how those things work. And, so much information could be being transmitted in video files that for malicious things to catch on and hitch a ride with them it is a threat that people are concerned with. And, one thing that I think is kind of interesting is a few months ago, I went to a hotel and they bragged that every single hotel room had Alexa in it. And while that seems kind of like a good idea, when you really start thinking about it, I mean, Mike, does Alexa ever stop listening?
I don't think so.
So, you know, while it was great that you could order room service by just telling her to get you what a grilled cheese sandwich or something, God knows what other things, if you were working from your hotel room and having conference rooms, I mean, who knows how all that data would be being parsed by Amazon or other people. And, you know, I've always wondered a little bit about Siri myself. So I think that all of this is to say is that even though if you don't have traditional medical devices, there are lessons to be gleaned from this fifth category of threats that merit some consideration. Hey, Mike, it's been a pleasure having this hour-long chat with you today. You are really a fantastic resource, and you can talk about all these really complicated things in ways that us mere mortals can understand. So thanks for buddying up today.
Oh, no problem. I'm sure we could go on for another hour or three, but I think we are hitting up against the clock.
Excellent. Well, I want to echo the thanks for both Leslie and Mike, not just for Mike, but for Leslie as well. You guys you took an hour and made it seem like it was a lot less. So I appreciate that. And not just explaining it, but then explaining it in a way that makes sense, is easy to understand, and also definitely applicable for anyone listening in the ARM or credit collections industry. So Leslie, Mike, thank you one final time for your insights and your time today. Thanks to everybody who listened to ask questions. Really appreciate that. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future, as well as a recording of this event will be posted in the next day or so. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Mike.